You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. Perhaps many of you have forgotten or probably don't even remember the events in 1971 regarding the Attica State Prison uprising, where prisoners basically tried to take over the entire prison, taking hostages, many of which were both civilians and prison guards. And that leads me to who we'll be talking with this weekend. My guest is Deanne Quinn Miller, the author of the new book, The Prison Guard's Daughter. And Deanne's father was one of the prison guards who lost his life back in September of 1971 during the uprisings. And she's put the emotions, the feelings, everything that has been plaguing her over these years regarding this episode and her father's death between the pages of the new book, The Prison Guard's Daughter. So for the next half hour or so, we'll be talking with Deanne Miller. Deanne, nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Never easy. So many times I've interviewed people through memoirs or just recollection of an event such as this, where a loved one was lost, whether it be an accident or in this case a prison uprising. But you were just a child. So what kind of effect? I mean, you know, parents don't just come to a 5 or 6 year old and say, let's sit down and talk, daddy or mommy, something's happened to them. And, you need to understand that. I mean, how was it even broken to you?
You know, that's very much of what my book is about, right, is that I was 5 years old at the time of the riot. And, I did not really, those memories I have, and I think that the trauma that the riot brought on within myself and my family left my memories extremely fragmented. And I don't remember much. I certainly do not remember my mom telling us that my father had passed away. I don't remember any of that. So that's kind of what my book is about, is the journey of me putting the pieces back together for the puzzle of, even though, you know who you are, you often don't know who your history is or what your history is. And it's important for me to find out just who my dad was. And in the finding out of who my dad was, I found out some very, interesting information about the riot that I had never known.
As you said, especially at that age, nobody sat you down, perhaps thinking, what was your mother? I would suppose that your mother thought, how do you break this to a 5-year-old? They're not able to deal with this or cope with this. As you got older, was she willing to talk to you? Was she willing to sit you down and explain or ask you if you had any questions or any emotions?
Not really. And that's the funny thing, right, is that, she talked to our pediatrician about, first of all, how to talk to us about our father's death. And she tells me that she spoke to the pediatrician on the phone, just kind of give them what they can understand. And I'm sure that she followed those directions precisely. But the thing is that I just think the trauma of the event, and as I got, as I lived through that year of being 5 and into 6 years old, I was finally able to put the pieces together that daddy wasn't coming home, and that something bad had happened to dad. And I put those pieces together, but it was the trauma of the change of my life during that time that really left me. I think I was just very much in survival mode as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
As far as talking about my father, I think that, back then, kind of the way that they dealt with things like that was just kind of pick up the pieces and let's just keep moving on. Right.
Right.
So, in a very short time, I was this kid who lost her father. I was living in Attica. We were living not very far away from the prison in a very, within the town. My mother had my sister, who was born after my dad passed away in 1972. In 1973, my mother is remarried. We move. I end up having another baby sister. I change schools. I change friends. I leave my grandparents. It was just so much change back then. And I think my mother was doing her very best to kind of try to keep things, moving and going. But basically, I was just kind of trailing behind, trying to survive, really.
It sounds like that. I mean, that first of all is the death of your dad, and then, as you said, the constant moving, the making of new friends, the leaving of old friends, an awful lot for an adolescent to have to deal with. Now, your younger sister, did she want to pursue answers the same as you?
No. Each one of my sisters really took a different path, if you will. I have a next younger sister, and she takes it all very differently. And then, of course, my sister Amy, who was the child who was born after my father was killed, she's very interested in things. But I have to preface the information first with, I learned something today. Is this something that you want to know? Because mm-hmm. everybody takes it in differently, and right. we're all dealing with this terrible tragedy.
Right. I mean, I give you credit in that regard. I mean, it wasn't like you just dumped on her. You kind of gave her the option. Do you want to hear this? Do you want to read this or not? But again, in that time frame, the 70s, I was basically a teenager, so a little older. But let me ask you, I mean, you must have seen plenty of friends, neighbors, relatives, with their mom and dad. Was there a sense of emptiness not having your dad there?
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a sense often of desperation because I just didn't feel, my family was changing so quickly, losing your dad without quite understanding why. I mean, I knew when we moved back to our house on Windsor Street and my father's, work shirt hung on the back of the desk chair for a very long time. That isn't, used to hang there and it would go, and then it would go on him and he'd go to work. I quickly realized then, I think that it was that dad wasn't coming home. And my mother did give me some information, but it was in small pieces. Now I recognize that as my mother, just trying to deal the very best that she could with the trauma that she is living through. I mean, she's lost her sweetheart,
Right.
And she's left with two babies, pregnant with another. And really, I think, talking about my dad was so very difficult. My grandparents, my father's parents, after my dad dies, basically just chose not to speak about him at all, So I didn't really have them to go to. I had very few people to go to, and I knew a very small story about my dad and who he was and the riot. And as I got older, that's really when I started reading books and I started getting interested in things, and I found out information about my dad that nobody had ever told me. And I found out information about the riot that I had never heard before.
Right. In contrast, today, in fact, we see it in every state, every city across the country, when either a police officer, a first responder, somebody noted in a community passes away, the first and foremost, there's quite a celebration of that person's life, and there's a desire and a need to keep their to keep them their what they did in the community, what they meant to their family, alive. Mm-hmm. I get the sense that back then in the 70s, in other words, they didn't celebrate one's life. Okay, passed away. It was a trauma. It was a horrible thing. You had this funeral services, and then it seems like everybody just didn't want to talk about it anymore. But let me ask you, knowing what you know now, do you think you would have been able at a young age to handle all that you know now?
No. Okay. There's no way. Mm. I mean, as an adult at 55 years old right now, there are times I can't handle the information that I've learned.
Right.
It is. I mean, what happened, was really such an atrocity. And the treatment of our families in the aftermath was just abysmal. And you have to understand that during that time, like you said, we don't really celebrate lives. I mean, we were having funeral after funeral after funeral. Right. Because we lost 10 hostages,
right.
Besides my father. And, my father died on September 11th after he sustained his injuries on the 9th, so he lived 2 days. But then on the 13th, we had 10 additional hostages that were state employees killed. So our small town experienced, I don't think anybody could have celebrated anything because they were just, I mean, the trauma that this small town, and I mean, we knew families and they were our neighbors. Often there was relatives within the small group of people that were killed, two relatives within the small group of 10 people.
Yeah.
It was really a tragic time for the town of Attica.
Yeah. An awful lot. Yeah, right. An awful lot for any one town, especially a small knit community. And I know from having friends in law enforcement, as well as you, even in first responders, fire, whatever it may be, emergency response, they're truly a family, and you know, it affects everybody deeply. I want to take a quick pause and let folks know that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us if you're just joining us. My guest this week is author Deanne Quinn Miller, and she has just written a memoir, The Prison Guard's Daughter, where she brings forth the emotions and the feelings of losing her father, Bill Quinn, back in 1971 at the Attica State Prison up in upstate New York, where inmates had taken over. Deanne was just a young girl, and over the years has gathered the information and really took many years to be able to formulate everything in her mind, and I'm sure throughout her psyche, in order to put everything between the pages of this new book. Deanne, I guess the other side is, and you sort of alluded to it, you lose so many people. I mean, the civilians, your father, the correction officer. What was it shortly after the uprising? I mean, they went in, and I remember that. I remember them going in and then killing prisoners and, you know, taking back the prison, if you will. But how has the state corrections department, were they, at least to your mother or to your recollection, did they stay in touch with families? Have they offered support to families? Or was it just, hey, you know, it's unfortunate, it happened. As you said, just move on. How's that been for you?
It's been very difficult. I mean, the state and the Department of Corrections, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the corrections officers, you know, were very supportive. Our, you know, people who were doing the same job as my dad, whether they were a corrections officer or they were civilian employees, all of those people were extremely supportive of, you know, our families that had been, you know, through this. But the state itself was not so kind to our families. And I think actually we were treated, you know, just terribly. I mean, part of, you know, what happened was, you know, after, you know, the funerals were paid for, the medical bills were paid for, and that was all paid by workman's compensation. So, you know, when you take an election of remedy, whether you take it or not, it precludes you from suing later on. So what they did, the state was very good and very sneaky and ready to cover up almost immediately with their paying of our hospital bills for our family members. Our funerals were all paid by workman's compensation. And then the state of New York, in the very short aftermath, said to the families, we're going to take care of you. And what that meant was, we're going to send you your husband's check so that you can support your family. And we're going to continue to send those checks, but we're not going to tell you that there's workman's compensation within those checks. So once those checks were cashed for those other families, they lost their election of remedy, were never able to sue the state. And in my opinion, the state did that very cleverly. They did it very quickly because they knew what would happen if these families could sue the state of New York.
Right, right. Was there an opportunity? Did anybody try, either as a cohesive group or individually, try to challenge the state of New York on that?
Yes. There was a woman by the name of Linda Jones. Her husband was killed during the riot, and she got this odd check for, like, I think it was like $27 or something like that, and it was a check for his food for the time that he was in the yard during those 5 days. And she took it to an attorney and said, this is just an odd kind of a thing. And he said, you're right, don't cash it. And because she didn't cash that check, that left her remedy open to be able to sue. Although it took her, I don't know how many years, from 71 into about 83 or 84.
Oh, wow.
But she did win a lawsuit against the state of New York that with interest, the payment was about $1 million.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, you know, as you said, I mean, they probably took a step back and said, you know, this is an unfortunate thing, but if we, you know, if we open up the floodgates here, we're going to be on the hook to these families for many years. But, you know, that must have been a wake up call. Just going fast forward, has that mm-hmm. changed now? I mean, if that were to happen today, do you think the state had learned anything? Would families be treated differently?
I sure in the heck hope so. And yeah. I will tell you that at least our corrections officers and our state employees would know better than to cash a check, right? Because that's how, you know, part of the reason we got duped. And when we were out to tell, you know, the truth of Attica is we let corrections officers that are currently working know now that, you know, be careful with whatever you do in the aftermath of you being injured or anything, because, you know, you know, we're just a little untrusting of the state, and yeah. Our history, you know, shows why we should be.
Yeah, yeah. The people of New York, when this became public, mm-hmm. I don't even remember who was governor at the time. Who was governor at that time?
Nelson Rockefeller.
Okay, not Nelson Rockefeller. Okay. Was there outcry? Once this all started to unfold, I mean, I don't mean immediately, but I'm sure, you know, over time, many of the residents of New York got wind of this, you know, because that's how change happens. I'm sure you know that better than anybody, especially among state legislatures. Enough pressure was put on. So was there outrage even from people, complete strangers who didn't know you personally, but say, hey, look, you know, young family lost their sole means of support. What are we doing here for these people? I mean, so was there an outcry from the public in support of you guys?
Not really. Because you have to understand, the state was so clever, right? They started the cover-up right from the get-go. And, you know, by saying, we're going to take care of you. I mean, you have to remember, this is the 1970s. We were not critical of our employers, right. You know, our employers back then, right? We were, like, very trusting of them. And if they said they're going to take care of us, they're going to take care of us. And then there was a meeting where they brought the surviving hostages to a church in Attica and said, hey, listen, guys, let's just keep this under wraps, okay? It was a terrible, horrible thing. You know, you guys can get put it behind you. We're going to give you 6 months off. Also, within that 6 months worth of their payment while they were off recuperating from being held hostage, workman's compensation was put in their paychecks as well. So the state was really super clever in making sure that we all kept quiet, that we all kept to ourselves, no reason to talk about it. They encouraged people to not speak about it. And they did exactly what the state asked them to do because, you know, they were following directions, right?
Right, right.
And I have two corrections officers who were together for nearly 20 years doing, you know, this road travel where they can take inmates to prisons and hospitals and things like that. They were both held hostages, and never once did they speak about it while they were on the job.
Right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say the state did a fantastic job in covering it up
yeah.
and trying to keep us quiet. And I think in that quietness, the public didn't really know what was going on.
Right.
They just assumed the state was probably taking good care of us and, you know,
exactly.
Things keep rolling.
Because mm-hmm. I think especially, you know, today everything is 24/7 news cycle. So nothing, whether it's completely accurate or not, there always seems to be, you know, that thread. And then before you know it, you know, it unfurls. And
right.
You get public, not only local outcry, but even national sometimes to effect changes. How long was your father a prison guard there at Attica?
He started at Attica. He'd only been there about a little over a year and 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm. How old was he? He was a young guy.
He was 28 years old. Yeah, my father was only 28 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I know that. As the, you know, when these things started to escalate, when Attica started to escalate, as I said, state police, correction officers, and whatever else they could send up there went in to quell the riot. But, you know, the prisoners, the ones responsible for the murder of your father and the murder of civilians, Were any of them ever identified and tried?
Oh, yeah. And we have to remember, right, okay, the only person, the only correction officer that was ever killed by inmates was my dad. Mm. And that was on the first morning of the riot inside the prison. The other 10 that were killed during the retaking on September 13th.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. So just to make that clear,
yeah.
those individuals that were in the hostage circle were killed by New York State gunfire or corrections officer gunfire.
What was it that they were? Was this a breakout, or was this some? They were just going to take over the prison and hope that they get their demands met.
I think they, you know, they did take over the prison. You know, once they, you know, got the keys off of my father's belt, they had access to all points of the prison. So they were, you know, letting inmates out of all portions of the prison. And it's set up like a grid, so you have A, B, and C, and D. They ended up in D yard, which is a 100-yard by 100-yard interior walled place, and that's where they were. And that's where our hostages sat for 5 days.
Wow. But again, the bottom line, were these prisoners trying, I may be totally wrong in this, and that's why I want you to, you know, to clarify mm-hmm. for me. I thought that they were trying to get people, maybe the governor or somebody from the governor's office, or, you know, just they wanted to talk. They took the, like you said, they took the prison over, took prisoners. You know, we're not going to release these prisoners. We may even do harm, as they did with your dad, until we've had some kind of a conversation, some kind of a meeting with the state, because we want better conditions. What were they looking for? I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, they had a demand. They had a manifesto. They had, I believe at one time originally it was 26 demands, and then it went to 28 demands afterwards. But they were meeting all during those 5 days. You know, we had our superintendent and people going in and out of the prison, you know, talking with them in an attempt to, you know, quell this thing and end this. Well, I mean, they had an entire observers committee that was inside the prison that were people like Arthur Eve and John Dunn and Tom Wicker. And these people were trying their best to get, you know, the governor to understand what was going on. You know, while the riot, you know, why the riot was going on. But yes, there was negotiations going on the entire time.
As you just said, Governor Rockefeller certainly was, if not there physically, he was getting updates on a pretty steady basis. So he was kept informed as to what was going on, correct, the whole time.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. There were two observers specifically that were keeping in contact with the governor's office, and it was the governor who did order the retaking of the prison.
Okay. As you look back now and knowing everything that you know, mm-hmm. was that the best conclusion? Was that their only option?
No. Okay. No. I mean, you have to think 5 days, right? 5 days in miserable conditions. You know, it was raining. It was cold. I mean, even after I spoke to inmates, you know, later on in my life as I went on this journey, I mean, I spoke to so many that just said, man, we were cold, wet, and hungry. You know, we were, you know, get ready to just, you know, had we been able to come, you know, to another agreement or whatever it was, I think we would have just said, okay, you know, we're done. And, you know, I think the thing that we have to remember is that there's always time. Right. There's always time. We could have waited, but we didn't, because the governor had had enough. It looked poorly on him that these inmates were running amok, you know, within the prison. And it didn't look good for his political aspirations. And you know, we have these, you know, corrections officers and state employees that are sitting in there. They're clearly injured. They're clearly in danger. And he just wasn't going to have it anymore. So he ordered the retaking of what I believe was retaking of the facility, not exactly a plan to save those hostages that were state employees.
Yeah, no, because they just, they, you know, as you said, they just, with just massive manpower, just went in there and just opened fire at the, you know, a show of force, if you will, to take back the prison. So, yeah, and you know, I think the cloud that would hang over Rockefeller's image, I know he's no longer here, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, more lives were lost because, as you said, his feelings that perhaps his political aspirations, and we know he had plenty of those, were being dimmed by what was happening here. In the couple of moments that we have left, Dan, how do you deal with things on a day-to-day basis today? Are you able to look back on that and say nothing was done right, or at least in my eyes? I lost my dad at a very young age. I've written this book. I guess what I'm trying to say, has the writing of the book helped you?
Yeah, it has. It's always something. You know, I had started writing 10 years ago when Gary Craig approached me, who's my co-author, and said, you know, why don't we write a book? And I was just not in a great place then. And I just didn't think that I could go through the motions of writing and revisiting all of the stuff from my childhood, you know, to present day.
Yeah.
Writing it was, there was parts of it were just horrendously difficult, because you think that you put this stuff, you know, away, right, in your mind, and you go on with your life because you have children and family and, you know, other things become more important, but it is a constant nagging. When you lose your father, when your father is murdered in this kind of way, it never, ever leaves you. And people know who you are. People know who I am. They know what happened to me. Same with my sister. So anonymity is not really an option because we don't live that far from the prison now.
Right.
It was very difficult. I'm glad I wrote it. I do think it is helpful. I also think that people will have a better understanding of what it was like to be a daughter. And we have so many Leos out there, right? So many law enforcement officers that put that badge on or put that uniform on every single day, and they walk into these prisons, and they are the quiet heroes of our society because they're keeping those most dangerous from us in society behind these walls. And I never want them to forget what it is that they would possibly leave behind should something terribly wrong go, go wrong at work.
Yeah.
And I was that little girl that got left behind.
Yeah. I mean, just listening to how you summed it all up is perfect, because I think that's exactly, many people go through their daily lives not realizing that even though prisoners are incarcerated, you have extremely violent people. They're not inside that cell 24/7. Somebody has to be interacting with them on a day-to-day basis. Meals, exercise, medical attention, whatever it may be, and you put your life on the line. And as you said, for a young girl losing, it's traumatic enough at any age to lose a loved one, but I think under the circumstances, nobody can deny how this has affected you over the years and your family directly. I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we are running out of time. But the book is The Prison Guard's Daughter, My Journey Through the Ashes of Attica. The author has been my guest this evening, Deanne Quinn Miller. Deanne, if people want to perhaps find out more about you or post questions to you, how might they reach you?
We have a website that's up. It's called theprisonguardsdaughter.com. And there is information on there. There's a blog on there. If anybody wants to, email me through that website to ask questions, they certainly can. Yep. And I'd be happy to. I check it often, so I'd be happy to answer any of their additional questions they might have.
Great, great. And it is a great, it's very rare that a book like this comes across, because it is a personal, very personal memoir of loss. I think when you'd start to read it, even though you may not know the people, they're strangers to many of us, but by the time you end up finishing the book, you get the true sense that it could happen to anybody at any time. And, you can, I guess what I'm trying to say is you can put yourself in your shoes to some degree. No one can ever understand the depth of suffering and loss that you've encountered. But it does bring things home for sure. Again, The Prison Guard's Daughter, my guest has been Deanne Quinn Miller. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or anything at all to me directly. Certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.